floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. How's it going out there in podcast land? This is Chris Shiblett, and you are, of course, listening to another episode of Walking the Floor. I'm here home in Los Angeles, settling back into life after a grueling three-show tour down in South and Central America. Every show down there was amazing, so it's kind of hard for me to pick a favorite. We had Rock in Rio, we played Bogota, we played in San Jose, Costa Rica. I gotta say, on a personal note, on a touristy type of note, the highlight for me was surfing two epic days out at Witch's Rock in Costa Rica. Big thanks to my new buddy Jerry at Tropic Surf for ferrying us out there a couple days in a row. We scored, it was unreal, and now I'm back in Los Angeles surfing 1 foot slop with 8,000 people. Woohoo! I just announced the other day that I'm going to be opening up for Cadillac 3 at the Troubadour on November 2nd. Tickets are on sale now. Go get them. I understand that they're moving at a brisk pace. So go get your tickets today. I don't think I've ever played the Troubadour like solo, so I'm looking forward to it. You know, my mom used to go to see like poetry readings there back in the 50s, I think. And, you know, I, of course, used to go see Poison and Faster Pussycat and Jet Boy and bands like that back there in the 80s. And it's a super legendary room, so that should be really, really fun. All right, let's pay some bills. You know, nobody makes the best gear from the best brands more affordable than Zounds. You know that, Zounds.com. You never, ever have to pay full price all at once when you buy from Zounds if you use their exclusive payment plans. You want to create music, not how am I going to pay for this headaches? And Zounds always makes it as easy for you as possible. So there's no interest ever. And they make the whole thing very easy. So get on over to Zounds.com today. All right, kids, let's talk to Kendall Marvel. All right, so as many of you listeners probably know, Kendall Marvel is my good buddy. I've talked about him a million times on this show, probably. I've interviewed him before. We've toured together. We've written songs together. I've played his Honky Tonk Experience at the Exit Inn a couple times, and I'm just a big fan of him and his music, and he has an amazing new record that just came out on Easy Eye Sound, Dan Auerbach's label, and his new record's called Solid Gold Sounds. Honestly, if you haven't listened to it yet, it just came out a couple days ago, and if you haven't listened to it yet, go spin that thing right now before you dive into this interview. You will not be disappointed. I loved his first album, but this is, in my opinion, a big step up even from that. And the songs are amazing. He wrote with some amazing legendary songwriters like John Anderson and Big Al Anderson, bunch of folks. Dan Auerbach produced it. And we talked a little bit about some of that stuff on my Seven Peaks Festival episode from a few weeks back. But here now to get into the weeds on all things Kendall Marvel is my great friend, Kendall Marvel, on Walking the Floor.
I don't know. You don't have to be too alive. I'm pretty fired up. Yeah, yeah.
Check one, two.
That's working. You can have that water. I stole that from the Basement East last night.
I like it. It gets stolen.
Yeah. All right. And make sure not to put your phone anywhere near this. Because I learned the hard way the other day doing an interview that makes an enormous racket. Yeah. Oh man, yeah, it's funny. So I went back and played Basement East again last night, and had like a, you know, like more like a 45-minute set or whatever.
Right.
And I walked out and I said something like, "Oh man, I was gonna get all fucked up and come over here, throw some drums, fight the sound man." You know, I heard Quaker City Nighthawks stole
me
my thunder,
too.
And it was just like crickets. I was like, "Oh, I guess that's
too soon."
Yeah, too soon. Exactly.
Almighty.
All right, so we talked about your new record that's coming out here in a minute. Mm-hmm. Solid Gold Sounds. We talked a little bit about it when I saw you up in Colorado. But let's get deeper into it.
All right.
Your new album, it's like, it's country as fuck. It's like, it's, I don't know how else to describe it. It's so country.
It's kind of what I do, yeah.
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 Yeah, but it's like, it's not... You know, there's a lot of different strains of country, especially floating around the world of Americana and whatnot. Right. But yours just, it sounds like, it's like, almost like, has like a classic.
So, you know, like a lot of wine country.
Well, it's like, yeah. A lot of people, you know, or bite the outlaw thing, or maybe even do the honky tonk. There's different eras that get like, you know, retro or sure. whatever. And yours almost, I mean, it doesn't sound retro, but it almost feels like it's not pulling from those eras. It's pulling from like 80s, even maybe a little 90s.
In sure, there, absolutely. Really. And then the dudes that played on, I mean, they were the original retro guys. You know, they played on everything from Pretty Woman to Good Time Charlie's Got the Blues.
No shit.
And The Ghetto for Elvis. Yeah, they've all right. that Chip Moman stuff out of Memphis. I mean, yeah, them guys, they've been around forever.
How has Auerbach corralled all those folks?
You know, I guess he's just such a fan of that era of music,
right?
And I guess
particularly the Memphis thing, like,
yeah,
like
he
the
just
Dan Penn and guys like that.
I guess he just found out those guys were, you know, just kind of sitting around not working like they used to, you
yeah
know, kind of as musicians do sometime, you know. The every year changes, new blood in town,
and yeah,
them great players get lost in the shuffle for some crazy ass reason.
But you've been here, you've been in Nashville for a long time. Like, did you know a lot of those? Had you worked with a lot of those guys?
I knew one guy, two,
really?
Another guy I'd used on some sessions here in town, and but Russ Paul was really the only guy that I knew well.
Really,
the rest of them was like all new for me.
And how did you wind up connecting with Auerbach in the first place?
Clay Bradley introduced me to Dave Ferguson. Fergie, okay. We call him. And Ferg and Dan do a lot of stuff together. Ferg produces Sturgill Simpson and Tyler Childers and Margo Price, that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay. But and he Dan, also did, like, some Johnny Cash stuff.
Yeah,
like,
all that stuff with Rick Rubin. Yeah, I mean, he worked with Cash a long time. So he did all that Americana stuff that Cash he was involved in. Worked for Cowboy Jack Clement, you know, back in the day. So
no, well, he goes
yeah,
back Ferg, that far.
Yeah, Ferg's been around a long time.
Wow.
And he liked it, and he said, let me play this for Dan. You know, he said, I'm doing a lot of stuff with him, and he might be into this. And I'll be damned if he wasn't.
Well, so what are those, I mean, what are those guys like in the studio? Like, what is Dan's problem? Because it seems, because it's funny, I just interviewed Yola, who's a label mate of yours.
Queen.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah.
But I just came from that interview, and you know, there are some parallels in between, you know, your experience working with Auerbach and hers, and it sounds to me, and I've never even met the guy, much less worked with him, but it sounds to me like he's sort of recreating, and I don't mean this in the wrong way, the assembly line Nashville thing in a sense, but the good parts of it. You know, there's that thing that everybody complains about, you know, it's just, you know, you go on session guys and everybody just plays their thing and nobody gives a fuck, and it's just, yeah, right, blah, 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 you know, it's a team of writers and the artist doesn't have anything, you know what I mean? It's like, it's got some of those elements, it sounds like he gets all these great writers together and you write these amazing songs and he gets these, you know, these kick-ass session guys, but it's like the good part of that.
Yeah, and he don't overthink things, you know what I mean? He gets in there, a lot of these guys here in town and are from the school of Mutt Lang, you know, it's like, everything's perfect,
right?
You know, from the no drum kick, no drum clicks, and none of that crap. You know, they don't play to a click, they don't play to, there ain't no loops going on, none of that shit. And it's just like live music. We track that stuff live, and there's some flaws in it. And the flaws is what, when one person flaws, they're all flawing.
Right.
So it makes it cool. Jamie Johnson does his records the same way.
Right.
That's why they're so cool sounding to me. They sound
like Dave Cobb does.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
Cobb does the same thing.
Way,
yeah.
And has a similar setup where he's, you know, curated these musicians and curated these writers. And,
yeah. And Dan has had found a niche there. He's got his, the Easy Eye Band, he calls them. And I told somebody the other day, I said, it's like you go to some of these craft breweries and you'll sample four or five of these beers and they're all completely different.
Hmm.
But they all have something in them that's like links them to one another. Like, man, I taste that in all of them. I'm like, not exactly sure what that is. Well, that's Dan. You know, and all these artists he has, me and Yola and D. White and Early James and all these cats he's working on over there. And none of us are anything alike musically.
Right.
But there's a common thread, a common sound that runs through all of those records.
When you were getting songs together for this record, did you go back through your... Because, you know, for people listening that don't know, you're... songwriter, you've been a songwriter for years, you got right. a shit ton of songs mm-hmm. and back catalog and everything, songs right. that you could dig through. Did you dig through those, your old songs, or were you just in there writing new stuff with these
brand
guys?
New songs? We wrote every one of them in 3 or 4 days, and that was that. And yeah, so he didn't even ask to hear any of my old songs.
Who were some of the writers that were involved in it? And would you go with, like, would it be you and Dan Auerbach and just kind of bring in one other guy?
Most of the time, yeah. Right. Sometimes it was just me and Dan. But we had Pat McLaughlin, who I've written with in the past. Me and Pat are old friends. And Paul Overstreet, which I'd never written with Paul, big fan. Ronnie Bowman was a writer on there. We wrote a thing or two with Ferg, a thing or two with D. White. They ended up not making the record, but it was all, you know, most people hadn't written with a bunch.
What about
Big Al Anderson, which I've known Big Al. We wrote for the same company for years, you know.
Okay.
We've both been with Steve Marklin over at Downtown. We was with Steve at Windswept, you know, back in, I think I told somebody the other day, 17 of my 20 years in town, I've written somewhere that Steve signed me.
Right.
So for some reason, he hadn't got enough sense to drop me or just likes me. I'm not sure which it is. But Big Al was great. I mean, he got one of my favorite songs on the record called Blood in the Water. And seemed like I'm missing some. Oh, John Anderson. How the hell am I missing
Anderson,
John Anderson?
Right. Yeah, who co-wrote the first single.
Exactly. Right. And Hard Time of the Truth. And I'm such a big John Anderson fan, all the way back to his first single, or the first one I remember hearing was a song called 1959. Mm. And just a great old song. And the
Did
Wild
he
and
sing
Blue
on
days.
Your record? Is he on
he
the
didn't.
Song?
Matter of fact, he didn't even sing when he was writing.
Oh, really?
No, he just, and I'm dying to hear him sing, you know. That's the first time I've ever been, not intimidated, but a little bit starstruck.
Yeah.
And, I've met way bigger stars than John Anderson. Sure. But, I mean, he's such a big influence on my singing and what I do. I mean, I seen him at a Merle Haggard show at the Ryman, one of the last ones Haggard done. And I remember running to him at the beer line and told him, I said, you know, I'm here to see Haggard, and I love him, but you're my favorite singer in this building.
Really?
And he was like, oh, hoss, you know, he's such a good dude.
He's got one of the most distinctive voices in country.
Oh, that's why I love him. Right, it's just such a
There's
unique,
nobody else that sounds like that guy.
There's not. And I call him a drive-by singer. Sound like he's going by in a car.
Right.
And he's a great guy, and he puts you right to ease, and he's just a good old boy that is really great at what he does.
It's interesting, you know, with Auerbach being, you know, producing the record and his label and everything, and he's sort of curating the whole scene. Like, he doesn't seem like, I mean, what do I know? I never worked with him, but it doesn't seem like he leaves his imprint on, like, his records don't come off sounding like a Black Keys record with somebody else singing or whatever. Like,
it's
really the one song on your record has like an Auerbach-y kind of rip, that Cadillac and song.
Yeah.
See, I was like, oh, that he must have come up with that.
Yeah,
that sounds like him, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
he did.
But like, there isn't
some
a ton
of the
of
tones. I can hear a couple of the, like a slide part, and it's got a smidgen of a Black Keys tone, something he would do.
Right.
But yeah, he separates his production completely away from what he does as an artist,
right,
which is cool. You know, a lot of people just, who wouldn't want to make a Black Keys record? You know,
sure.
Yeah, if I made a record sound like a Black Keys record, I'm not going to be pissed off about it.
Yeah, I might sell a few copies.
Exactly.
You know, with working with all those folks, I know you've talked in the past about, you know, writing, at least when you were coming up as a songwriter, writing with people who you thought were a better writer than you, you know, mm-hmm. further down the line or whatever, and learning from them. What are some of the things that you took away from those sessions? And did you have any of those moments with these guys?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, people like Overstreet. I mean, he has written some of my favorite songs, songs I cut my teeth on.
Right.
You know, Big Al's the same way. You know, Big Al hit it later than Paul. But, I mean, his songwriting was a huge influence of me even playing music. Mm. All that Randy Travis stuff.
Right.
You know, Keith Whitley stuff. I mean, he's just a great songwriter. And he's been consistent for how many years now? Since the mid-80s, probably 84, right. 85, somewhere, you know, we started having On the Other Hand and Forever and Ever Amen, all these great songs. And that dude has figured out a way to stay consistent as a songwriter without losing his coolness, without following the trend that's going on, you know.
Right.
He might write a Kenny Chesney song, but it doesn't sound like a snaps and clicks and pops and loops and things, you know.
Right.
It sounds like a Paul Overstreet song.
Sure. The trend's
been
to him.
That's hard for a songwriter.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
They come in waves. You'll see guys, they'll win Writer of the Year for a year or two, and then they'll go away when this fad goes away.
The
and
thing
Paul
that
has
known for,
not done that. He stayed consistent.
I interviewed Todd Snyder mm-hmm. a couple days ago, which was super fun.
I bet it was
fucking hilarious. But he was talking about when he was on John Prine's label, mm-hmm. that Prine would like read through his songs, read through his lyrics, and like critique them with him, and go like, you know, you're not being honest there. You know,
right? Whatever. Shit, you gotta listen to fucking John Prine.
John Prine, you know? Right? And like, and he said something that Prine said to him that like I thought was such good like songwriting advice. It's so kind of hard to. And I think Prine said something to him like, "You're trying to be smarter than me there." Which I thought was great. You know, like have you ever had a moment like that? Have you ever gotten like rung up by one of these guys? Maybe not like recently, but not, when you were coming up. You know?
Not really. I mean, Dan, he didn't. I mean, we wrote them songs together, and you know, if he didn't like some, he just sit there and not say nothing. You know, if he likes it, he's like, "I like that."
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I fancy myself, you know, more of the lyric guy sometimes. You know, and especially with a guitar player like him, you know, when you're in the room. But he's just as good at lyrics too. He come up with just as many things in the songs as I did.
Yeah.
When you're talking about Todd Snyder a while ago, trying is the key word in that line. When you said you're trying to be smarter than me, John Prine.
Right.
Trying.
Yeah, exactly. Is, yeah. Exactly. That's funny.
I'm not sure what it hurt worse, whether he didn't like my song or he's just saying you're not as smart as I am.
Right. Right. So with your last record, did you put your last record out yourself, or did that?
I did, yeah.
Right. Yep. So how do you like working with Easy Eye?
Oh, I love it.
How's the
label? It's nice to have somebody, because I mean, I thought you just cut a record and put it up on iTunes or on YouTube, and that was that.
Right.
There's a lot of shit that goes into putting a record out that I don't want to ever have. I don't want to deal with. You
especially
know?
Nowadays, man. Putting out a record, I don't think people like. I'm probably every interview I did this week, I bitched about this a little bit, just because I'm on the. Just coming off the putting out a record myself, and like I've come to the realization in recently that I love making records and I love playing shows, and all the other stuff I don't enjoy.
I want other people to do it for now,
right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But I mean, that's tough, you know, because then you have to corral those people, pester those people, organize right. those people, get those people to communicate.
A lot of people do. It hasn't been that way with them. They're on the ball.
Yeah.
You know, I think Dan probably stays on people's ass a lot. You know, they all work for him, and
yeah.
he's hired the right people. You know, Tom Osborne and some people over there to run this label for him. And Tom don't rest. I mean, he's a smart dude, quirky dude, smart dude. But I mean, he's on the ball. You know, he don't. They're playing with their money. When you're playing with your own money, it's a little different
right.
ball game. You know, when I was doing my own thing, I could, I'm not going to do that because, you know, I can't afford that or whatever. You know,
yeah.
these guys, when you're playing with your own money, they get shit done a lot more than they would if they was playing with somebody else's.
Yeah, for sure. So you've been hitting it hard, touring a lot this year.
I have, more than I ever have in the past, that's
right.
for sure. Probably going to get busier, I'm thinking.
Do you still divide, like, are you dividing your time between songwriting and just going out and doing so, or are you just kind of taking a break from being a, like, professional songwriter?
Well, I'm not really taking a break from it. There's still I still write a little bit. I still write with Brothers Osborne quite a bit. You know, I pick and choose. You know, I still write with Stapleton.
Right.
But I don't just go in a room and try to write songs to get on the radio with anybody anymore.
Right.
You know, I'll write with Waylon Payne, people who's like-minded, who is, like, so far off the beaten path of country radio that they're not chasing, trying to get a cut on somebody. They're just trying to write a great song.
Right.
I still write with those kind of people.
Yeah.
And that's where I tend to get the best stuff, in my opinion.
It's funny, man. You know, I had never seen you. Well, I played at your Honky Tonk Experience, I guess, before we toured together. So I had seen you play in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd never seen you play live, do like just like a dude and his guitar thing
right.
until we toured together.
Mm-hmm. Which was fun as hell.
That was a really fun run of shows. But it's interesting, you know, for like, I didn't realize how powerful your voice is. Your fucking voice fills a room.
Oh, thanks, man.
I mean,
I call that loud, but you call it filling, yeah.
Well, I call that sitting around backstage, like, waiting for it to be my turn and listening to you play, going, fuck.
Where was we at when I was out there trying to sing and you was back there doing your warm up? I was like, what the hell is he doing back there? I thought you was just messing with me. This son of a bitch is over here just trying to ruin my show.
No, because I'm back there going like, I got to do my little like, la, 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 just trying to get ready to go on after you. Yeah, but that was in L.A.
That was
in L.A. And I should have known better because I remember like at fucking soundcheck or whatever, like if somebody was downstairs and you were in the up, so you could hear them. clear as day. Right, you know what I mean? So of course, while you're on stage, I mean, there's just some little paper thin door between where I was
it
and
was
you
being on stage. Yeah. Like, what in the hell is he doing?
Making a racket. Shut the fuck up. I think you did tell me to shut up, but I didn't even hear it. I just kept going.
He was back there warming it up, man.
Yeah. Yeah. But my point is like, you know, as an artist and as a performer, I mean, you're like, it's you got a big, strong voice.
Oh, well, thanks. You know, and that's, I guess maybe that's from just playing acoustic all those years, you know.
Right.
Just
trying. Were you always doing that even through all the years of
yeah, I mean,
full-time
even my young stuff? Days, I mean, that's, right. You know, when I started playing music, I'd done it all through high school and stuff. I'd done a little solo thing, you know, yeah. All the little bars and stuff, singing over loud people. And, you know, and Dan, when we was doing this record, he really toned my singing down. And he was like, cause I, you know, instead of, don't sing like you're standing at the exit end, you know, singing in front of a bunch of people. Tone it back, you know.
Right.
Sing quiet. Sing down here like this. He said, that's what microphones are for. He said, I'll be able to turn it up and make it that much bigger.
Right.
So it was a whole different recording process for me.
How does that translate to then going out and doing these new songs live?
Well, for one thing, it saves my voice. Approach. At the end of the night, I'm not hoarse.
Right.
You know, singing these songs that way, you know. And then let that, you know, they got good microphones on the stage. Turn that son of a bitch up.
Let the mic do the work,
and then, you know, I can sing five nights a week instead of three, you know,
keep your band at a Ray Price volume.
That's a hard part.
That's the hard part.
And
right?
It's hard live because you want that stage, you know, if you get a real quiet stage, you lose some energy sometimes.
Yeah.
So, I can't hear for shit anyway. So I'm just like, turn my monitor up, you know, get my voice honking in that monitor.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, we're learning on all that live stuff there on how to capture it and make it sound, you know, with a small band. We're going lean and mean right now, me and bass, drums, guitar, and that's a lot of sound to make up off of that record, you know, so.
That is really interesting, and I go through that myself. You know, when you're making a record, you can pull out all the tricks. You've got like fucking string sections and, you know, keys and all this stuff, you know, all over the place. And then to transform that live, it's like you have to find. I remember I had a thing called Chris Shiflett and the Dead Peasants for a little while. And the first record that I made as that was the first record I had like pedal steel on, and everything was really acoustic based. Mm-hmm. And then I put a little band together to go out and tour it. And I couldn't afford to bring a fucking pedal steel player, keyboard player, any of that shit. So then all of a sudden, I realized like, and when I wasn't playing acoustic, I was playing everything loud, and it just sounded like a fucking stupid rock band. I was like, this doesn't capture anything off the.
Yeah, sometimes you gotta rock and roll it up a little bit.
Right.
In them positions, you know, I've got a great band, and my guitar player, he's good at learning the steel parts and things till we can afford a steel player and a good B3 player.
Yeah.
You know, B3 player will come first when I can afford that full time. You're like, that's what I really want. That fills up all that room.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of cool organ on them records.
Like
so
syrup.
Sound like a dragon.
Fills in all the cracks.
All that
big roar
and stuff. But yeah, it's been fun so far.
You know, when I read that you had covered a Bee Gees song for your new record and then the title Solid Gold Sounds, I was like, oh shit, there's gonna be like a slamming fucking disco groove on this thing.
It's anything but.
I know and that's an interesting thing, like the Bee Gees song that you guys covered is I've got to get a message to you, which, like, you listen to the Bee Gees version of it and it's, you know, it's a great tune. I wouldn't hear that as a country song.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I love that. I love when somebody takes something from another genre.
Sure. And he didn't even play me that. He said, let's do a cover song. And I was like, what do you got in mind? You know what? There's a lot of songs out there I love. He said, something that's not country.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah. And he played
me. So you were looking for something like that.
Yeah. And he played me that song, but there was a band called Swamp Dog that done it. Like a blues band. And it was way different than the Bee Gees version.
And I was
like, yeah, that's cool. And then I listened to it a couple times and realized what a sad ass song it is. The dude's, you know, on death row. You know, it's a death song.
Right.
Know? Anytime you can kill somebody in a song, I'm all for it.
Yeah,
you know?
It's Long Black Veil or something.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we got in there and all that gorgeous steel and piano and stuff they put on that. It just feels like a classic song.
Yes.
And that may be my favorite vocal on the record.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah,
I love the ballads. Those
it's a little more ballad heavy than my last one.
Let It Go in particular, and Must Have Kept It for Himself. Those two songs are like the tearjerkers.
Yeah, Must Have Kept It for Myself is probably my wife's favorite song, but it's probably my favorite. And Dan and I wrote that by ourselves. We'd I think Roger Cook was supposed to write with us that day and had either got double booked or didn't show up, whatever. But I owe him a beer for not showing up, because I'm not, you know, maybe we may not have wrote that song if he had to show up. He's a great writer. I don't know if you know Roger or not, but
yeah,
he wrote A Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress. I'd Like to Buy the World a Coke. You know, I mean.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And wow. He plays everything on a ukulele. He'll come to a writer's night. He's written some stuff with John Prine, and it does everything on a ukulele. So he's an interesting dude. Yeah. And I was looking forward to writing with him, but it didn't hurt my feelings that he didn't, you know, that we wrote that song that day without him.
It's got that classic, like the hook line ties the whole thing up in this perfect
bow. Yeah, yeah.
When you write, and I've heard other writers say this, like, do you start with the hook line?
Sometimes, you know, in Nashville, I remember when me and you wrote for your record,
yeah,
it was like, you know, your world's way different than ours, you know.
Totally.
I
just came in with a riff, like, hey, what about this?
Yeah. And that's cool. That's interesting, because, I mean, most of the time we don't do that here. Every now and then somebody will have a signature lick, but it's usually just a,
right,
you know, half-ass lick and to give to a guitar player to really make something cool out of it, you
know? Right, right,
right. But that, you know, that song, I had a title, and actually that was in a book. I read that in a book. A guy said that.
Right.
And I was like, good Lord, has nobody ever written that? And I Googled it, and like, nobody has written that. And I know a ton of people, songwriters, have read this book.
Right.
So I immediately was like, I'm writing that sandwich tomorrow.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's one of my favorites. The whole thing is just, I mean, it just, and we cut 16, 17 songs. You know, so there's a lot of stuff that I really liked.
10.
Oh, wow. There's a lot of stuff that I really liked that didn't make it to the record. We actually covered a Dean Martin song called Houston. That's really cool. Got a real Waylon feel to it. And
right.
We still might finish it and hopefully do something with it, you know, some sync stuff or something. But
think any of that stuff, like, you put out an EP or anything, or just maybe?
Maybe. I mean, you know, that'll be Dan's call. You know, I mean,
when
you pay for it, you own it. So it's not, you know,
right,
it's not really my call on what they do with it.
So how does that work in the studio when you guys were working? Do you go in and just bang out the whole song that day? Are you doing like a couple songs a day, a few songs a day?
When we're writing them, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Demo session just become the album at a certain point?
Oh, no, huh? No, we went in and we wrote 4 songs a day for 4 days.
Mm.
And that was the record. We wrote the whole, everything in them 4 days.
And is that a comfortable pace?
It was then. Normally, it wouldn't be. You know what I mean? It wasn't like we was under pressure, like, we got to write these songs now.
Yeah.
You know, they just fell out. I mean, it was just easy. It was the easiest environment I've ever worked in.
Yeah,
I mean, just like a couple dudes hanging out, writing songs and laughing, and all the extracurricular activities that go on at ECI. You know, he's always feeding you good. And you got a guy that makes really good Manhattan, or makes a good, what's the other drink I'm thinking of? It's not a Manhattan. It's a, my blanket on it. Old fashioned.
Makes
a good old fashioned. Right. So it was just like, you know, Dan always, he's a street.
Even his drinks are retro, man.
His drinks are retro. His food is retro. It's just like, man, he's right on time. Nobody ever goes hungry over there.
Yeah, that's good.
And then, you know, then we got the band in there, and that was, they didn't get in any hurry, but they're very quick when they don't have to be.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
very
efficient,
shall I say.
Yeah.
They go in there and knock that stuff. I think we tracked 3 days and sang the vocals live, and might have had an overdub or two, you know, on my vocals, and that was that. I mean, it was done. They worked really strange, because they have these little boards up there on his mixing board, him and Alan Parker and Ferg, and they're messing with them all the time, and Alan's pretty well mixing the whole time you're tracking. Like at the end of the night, we'd listen to 4 songs, 5 songs that we'd tracked that day, 6 songs, whatever it was, and they're pretty 80% mixed up, you know what I mean? It's just like, this is going to sound a lot like this when it's finished. It's not going to come in and be like, oh my God, you know, all this different stuff on it.
Right.
Then he would come in back later and do the strings, you know, they overdubbed that stuff, which I got to watch a little bit.
Is that
bit
a live string
section? Yeah.
Shit. How many people?
One dude. He just done different
one
parts,
dude.
Yeah. Yeah, and
that's
it
crazy.
Was, yeah, I mean, I
even
never,
the way this, it's not, even beyond the arrangements, the string arrangements, it's the sound of it.
Right.
Nails that, like, late 60s, early 70s thing.
Well, all his gear is vintage. You know, everything he owns over there is vintage. Or you should really, at some point next time you're in town, I'd love to take you over there.
Yeah.
He's got so many old guitars.
I'd love to see
it. It's just such a cool, vibey place.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks exactly like the sounds that come out of it.
Right.
You know, it's a really cool joint.
Yeah. Well, do you want to play a song?
Sure.
From the new record?
Yeah.
My friend.
I like his guitar.
Beautiful. Did you steal that from Auerbach Studio?
I did not. I was actually out on the road right with the Brothers Osborne, and this was hanging in the bus. And it was kind of the bus guitar, you know. It's a 60s.
Damn, that's a pretty nice bus guitar.
It is. 60s model J50 Gibson. And John, I was like, man, I was playing. I was like, I love the way this thing plays. I said, if you ever sell it, let me know. And he said, I'll sell it. I said, man, what do you want for it? He said, what I got in it, $1,000. I was like, damn. And the band just fell out. They was like, son of a bitch. So now every time I go
on,
every time I go on the bus, they got some cool guitars. I'd be like, yeah. You want to sell that guitar? And the band would be like, you shut the hell up.
Get the fuck out of here. How loud are you going to sing?
Moon, I go to heaven. Yeah, I think I'll sing that tune you like.
All right, beautiful.
Like I said, this is my wife's favorite tune. Dan was really good about it. My last record, you know, it's pretty guy-oriented. You know, it's like in-your-face angst and, you know, makes you want to fight. This one, my bass player hit it right on the head. I think he called it Lava Lamp Love Making Music is what he called it. So.
Perfect.
But so we aim this a little more at the girl. If I die and go to heaven, soon as I walk through that gate, and I lay eyes upon my Maker, first thing I'm gonna say, thank you for that warmth you put in my life. She's what kept me going, treated me so right. Honey, I could live forever and never love nobody else. God made anything better than you, He must have kept it for Himself. The way you helped me fight my demons, nursed me through the black and blue, always know just what I'm needing, and all the little love and things you do. Well, thank you for believing, never losing faith, when I gave you every reason to go and walk away. Honey, I could live forever and never love nobody else. If God made anything better than you, He must have kept it for Himself. Kept it for Himself.
Yeah, buddy.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
All afternoon. All right, that was Kendall Marvel on Walking the Floor. Go check out his brand new record, Solid Gold Sounds, out now on Easy Eye Sound. Solid Gold Sounds out on Easy Eye Sound. Check it out. Like I said, you won't be disappointed. I'm going to put a bunch of links up on my website, walkingthefloor.com, so you can go check out whatever Kendall's up to. I think he's out on the road right now, maybe with Chris Stapleton, or he just was, or he's about to be. Whatever. Find it. Find him. Support your local music scene, people. Come on. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. I'm off this weekend. By the time this thing posts, I will have already played at ACL. I got a crazy day down in Austin. I'm going to fly down there on Saturday, play an acoustic set on the radio, do some interviews, play a set at ACL, then do some Waterloo Records signing, and then bop on over to the Continental for a late night show. I think I'm playing at midnight with the Cordovas and Leon the Third. So it's going to be a nutty, nutty weekend. I'm going to be very tired, and then I turn around and fly home on Sunday, man. So I barely get to even enjoy Austin because I'm just going to be zipping through it like a lunatic. Anyway, I'll see you in a couple of weeks. This is Chris Shiflett over and out on Walking the Floor. Adios, amigos!